Hello, America, and welcome to the Christmas Eve edition of John Solomon Reports, a podcast from Just the News, where I hope you are preparing for a blessed and special holiday weekend with your family. I know I am, but we also wanted to give you a little dose of news, a little something to scratch that news itch before you head into the holidays with eggnog and family celebrations and maybe even fruit cakes, though that's not my favorite. Well, today we're going to do just something short and sweet from someone who got an early Christmas present from President Trump, and that is George Papadopoulos. We are bringing him on the show to talk about the extraordinary experience he had going through the Russia case and then finding out yesterday, late in the evening, that the president had pardoned him along with two former Republican congressmen and several other people, including four Blackwater security guards from an earlier Iraq incident. Some major pardons heading into the Christmas holiday, but this one for those who followed the Russia investigation, for those who thought that George Papadopoulos was charged with a process crime because they couldn't find Russia collusion on him. This pardon was particularly poignant. And so we're going to talk to George in just a second. He's coming on to share what it was like to find out, what he learned, what happened, what he's going to do going forward. I just want to remind everyone that we're going to go to commercial break and then we'll bring George in here. But before we do that, let's remind everybody the significance of the George Papadopoulos saga as part of the larger Russia collusion story. So it was George Papadopoulos upon whom the FBI first opened the Crossfire Hurricane investigation. They opened up on the allegation that he might be colluding with Russia to obtain Hillary Clinton's hacked emails on behalf of the Trump campaign. The information, the impetus for opening it, if you believe the FBI's documents and testimony, was that a ambassador from Australia, a guy named Alexander Downer, who was the Aussie ambassador to London at the time, and previously was a major donor to the Hillary Clinton and Bill Clinton Foundation, the Clinton Foundation. He arranged for $25 million of Australian tax money to go to the Clinton Foundation a decade or two earlier for AIDS initiatives in Africa. So he's a friend of the Clintons, a supporter of the Clintons, a financial backer of the Clintons. He walks in or sends information belatedly in July of 2016 to the FBI, alleging that back in May of 2016, he had this encounter at a wine bar with George Papadopoulos. And during that conversation, George Papadopoulos mentioned that he had been approached or had some discussions about Hillary Clinton emails that the Russians had hacked. And so based on that, they opened up what is known as a FARA investigation, Foreign Influence Investigation. And they predicated the entire Crossfire Hurricane. Once they got it opened on Papadopoulos, they really didn't do much investigating on Papadopoulos. And instead, they focused on Carter Page, Paul Manafort, Michael Flynn, among others. And yet the Papadopoulos investigation, which, by the way, he had the FBI codename Typhoon, they ran one informant up against Papadopoulos and learned something very powerful. I believe it was in September of 2016. The informant is known to be Stefan Halper, and he was this professor. He's also the one who targeted Carter Page at the FBI's direction. And Stefan Halper begins quizzing Papadopoulos in an encounter along with a young woman who went by the name of Azra, but she was really a U.S. government employee posing as a Turkish student for Halper. You must have been trying to get Hillary Clinton's emails, and was Trump doing it? And in that conversation, George Papadopoulos is recorded by the FBI. He tells unwittingly Halper, because he thinks Halper is a professor, not an informant, that, in fact, he would never have done anything like hack or encourage or take the emails on Hillary Clinton because it would be unpatriotic, it would be illegal, it would be improper. So unwittingly, he tells the FBI flatly, we didn't do it and we wouldn't have done it because we would have considered it illegal. That is powerful information that should have led for the case to be shut down. Instead, they left Papadopoulos behind, pivoted to the other figures, and then came back to Papadopoulos and accused him of a process crime, making a false statement to the FBI. The judge who took the case and took Papadopoulos' plea bargain found it incredibly thin. I think he sentenced Papadopoulos to less than 2 weeks in prison. Didn't find it to be a very big crime. And many people have looked at the Papadopoulos prosecution as an abuse of power or an excessive prosecution, given what we knew, and that the targeting of him seemed suspect from the beginning. And so Donald Trump, on Wednesday night, 2 days before Christmas, made the decision to pardon him and open up his life again, remove that conviction from his record. And that's why we're going to be talking to George Papadopoulos in just a second. So that brings you up to speed. We're going to have George on, and then we are going to let you get to your holiday festivities as quickly as possible on this Christmas Eve and one of the craziest years I've experienced in a long time, 2020. We'll be right back after this message from our advertisers and then our exclusive interview with George Papadopoulos. Hey folks, have you heard of cancer-fighting foods? The American Cancer Society discovered diets rich in fruits and vegetables may actually lower your risk of cancer. Think about that for a second. That's really important. Hopefully you hear this and run to the store for 5 servings of fruits and vegetables every day. But if you're like me, you probably don't have the time to do that, right? So maybe you should consider adding Field of Greens to your daily health regimen. Each fruit and veggie in Field of Greens was doctor-selected for studied health benefits. There's a heart health group, lungs, kidneys, and metabolism groups, even healthy weight. What your body needs is in each scoop of delicious Field of Greens. I take it every day. Sometimes I put it in a shake. Sometimes I put it in my egg white omelet in the morning. Field of Greens can help prevent, treat, and cure cancer? No, but it can powerfully help you out at your next checkup. Your doctor will notice your improved health or you're going to get your money back. Here's the most amazing thing about it. I started using Field of Greens a year ago. My cholesterol is down, my blood sugar is down, my weight's down, my health is up, my sleeping patterns are better, my metabolism is up. If you want to experience what I've experienced, go check out Field of Greens. Jump into the ring here. You're going to get an enormous benefit. And it's so simple. Single scoop, a couple of seconds, healthy lifestyle all day long. Now, thanks to our good friends at Brickhouse Nutrition, Field of Greens is going to give you a 15% off discount plus free rush shipping. All you got to do is go to fieldofgreens.com and use the promo code JUSTNEWS for your discount. That's promo code JUSTNEWS at fieldofgreens.com. Fieldofgreens.com, promo code JUSTNEWS. Go check it out. All right, folks, welcome back from the commercial break. And as promised, a very special guest on this Christmas Eve, somebody who got an early Christmas present, one would argue, from President Trump. George Papadopoulos is joining us, the newly pardoned George Papadopoulos. George, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, John.
Let's just start with the big news that happened with the last 48 hours. President Trump makes a decision to pardon you. I know that's something you wanted for a long time. A lot of people who supported you wanted that. What was that like? How did you find out? What was your first reaction and what it's been like? What has it been like for the last 48 hours?
Well, it was completely unpredictable. I had absolutely no idea that the president was going to pardon me. I specifically stayed out of the pardon process because I never wanted my situation to be viewed as a so-called political favor that might have be used by the left against the president. So I've always been very concrete about my expectation that all of the files in my case or situation, if you want to call it that, would be declassified, released to the public, and allow the public and the court of public opinion to come to the logical conclusion, which would hopefully have been a pardon. Because, of course, with my situation and the case and just the entire Russia scandal, it was, it's a global story. And the court of public opinion really matters. When the president pardons somebody, optics matter. And I was very happy that he had been declassifying a lot of documents regarding my case, including transcripts from spies in which I basically refuted any so-called allegations of a collusion case and possibly illegal behavior of the FBI against me. And I basically learned about being pardoned while I was watching TV with my wife, Simona. My phone started blowing up and just got probably hundreds of messages from everyday Americans who have been following the story, who have been supporting me and my wife through this tumultuous period. And that made it ever more special to both of us.
It had to be. And it's the sort of lightning bolt that can really correct a historical record. And I want to remind our listeners, most of them are up to speed on Russia, but it was your name, in your case, that gave the FBI their supposed predicate to look at Crossfire Hurricane, to open up on the idea that Donald Trump's campaign was colluding. And the information that they used to open up came from an Australian ambassador named Alexander Downer, who was a big Clinton Foundation donor earlier in his life. $25 million he arranged from the Australian government when he was foreign minister. He's the London ambassador for Australia, claims to have an encounter with you in a wine bar in London. And 2 months after that happens, in July of 16, he sends word to the FBI through Australian intelligence channels that you made some inkling that you knew Russia had hacked Hillary Clinton's emails and you might have been trying to get your hands on it. That's sort of the gist of it. And based on that information, the FBI opens up what now becomes Crossfire Hurricane and this big, long, winding investigation that found no collusion at all. But very early on, they run an FBI informant against you, and they find out the theory of the case is totally wrong. Why? Because you're talking to a professor, Stefan Halper. You don't know he's an FBI informant. And he starts quizzing you, were you guys at the Trump campaign trying to get Hillary's emails? And you say something to the effect, if I remember the transcript correctly, no, we wouldn't do something like that because it would be illegal. It would be traitorous. We wouldn't do that. And so the FBI knew you didn't do it and that unwittingly you had made a statement of innocence, and they don't tell the court. They don't close down your investigation like the evidence would warrant. You knew all along you had made those comments, but it took 3+ years for the exculpatory evidence against you to come out. What was it like waiting for the truth, what you knew to be the truth, to be validated by the declassifications we've seen?
Well, let's start with Alexander Downer. This meeting with Alexander Downer was portrayed in the New York Times as a chance meeting of two guys meeting in a bar drunk and just talking about, you know, nonsense.
Right.
And there's nothing actually further from the truth than that. The meeting with Alexander Downer was organized in very, what I believe were meticulous steps, including intermediaries of at least two foreign governments and potentially the U.S. government. During this meeting, I thought and believed that Alexander Downer was there to record me, spy on me. He was pulling his phone out and pointing it at me at least on four different occasions, asking me pointed questions about not the U.S.-Australia relationship, but actually about my ties to the Energy Consortium in Cyprus and Israel, potential lobbying. And why that was so interesting and bizarre is because during the Kevin Kleinsmith plea agreement that was released, John Durham presented facts that we did not know up until that plea agreement.
Yeah, and
that
great point.
That the entire case was so-called predicated on potential FARA violations, nothing else. And when Downer was questioning me the way he was about, potential lobbying or connections to, these high-profile consortiums that were in a very sensitive part of the world, that's not something normal of an Australian diplomat to be talking to an American in a London bar about while overtly recording or asking pointed questions. And then, of course, trying to extract information, which I believe, and I think the evidence is starting to point to it, a potential conspiracy with the other key character, Joseph Mifsud, who dropped the information about Russia and Hillary in my lap just 10 days or so before I met with Alexander Downer. So the notion that the New York Times narrative would be correct and would be ironclad and would have remained as long as it did is shocking to me. And every single week that passes and we continue to get this declassified information out there, it just really shows a completely different picture than was presented to the American public by the mainstream media.
Yeah, almost anything, almost all the original stories about collusion now have been completely unmasked as false. Let's remind people how the wine bar meeting really happened. You didn't request it. It didn't happen. Happen chance. Describe to folks how you showed up at the bar to meet Alexander Downer.
Yes, and that's why the chronology of my bizarre London adventure is so critical, and why I believe the months of March and April 2016 are actually paramount to understanding the origins and other key facts about how this entire thing started, whether it was illegal or not. After I leave Ben Carson's campaign, I'm working for a company named the London Center for International Law Practice. This is a company that recruited me randomly, possibly not randomly, to work for them right before I joined Ben Carson's campaign. And then again, after I leave Ben Carson's campaign, and they introduced me to this individual, Joseph Mifsud, who is basically at the epicenter of the entire Russia hoax in March and April. This individual on April 26th drops information in my lap unsolicited over brunch in a five-star hotel in London that the Russians have Hillary's emails. Not the typical environment you would actually discuss a so-called conspiracy with somebody, but that's where it happened. And shortly thereafter, approximately on May 1st, so about 5 days after this information was dropped in my lap, the U.S. government decides that they want to meet with me, including two attachés of the U.S. Embassy, Gregory Baker and Terence Dudley. Terence Dudley.
These both are in London, right? Attaché. We're still in London at this point, right? Yeah.
Yes, we're still in London, and Terence Dudley was the U.S. Navy attaché at the time, and Gregory Baker was following him along, meeting with me. So the notion that you know, this meeting with Downer was requested by me is false. I never requested this meeting. The Australian government had met with me two times before Joseph Mifsud dropped the information in my lap. They met with me after Joseph Mifsud dropped the information in my lap. The U.S. government met with me, and then Alexander Downer met with me. So the entire sequence of events running up to this extremely bizarre meeting with Alexander Downer seems to have been very orchestrated, arranged, premeditated, and potentially, you know, involving the Five-Eyed Intelligence Alliance in order to circumvent U.S. Law when targeting an American abroad.
Now, it's important to remind folks, because we still don't know the genesis or contents of this, but a couple of days before Downer approached you in the bar, and I think that was May 10th, is that correct?
May 10th, 2016 is when I met Downer, and yes.
Right. We know 2 days earlier from text messages and other declassified information, the head of FBI counterintelligence, the boss for Peter Strzok, went to London for some form of an intelligence meeting, which, based on his answers to Congress, had something to do with Russia in collusion, but he can't talk about it. So he's there 2 days before, and then you walk into the wine bar. I want to nail this down for people who don't know the details as well as you and I. When you go to the wine bar, were you expecting to meet someone there?
So the Australian government had reached out to me by mid-April 2016, which was extremely bizarre, considering that candidate Donald Trump never even uttered the word Australia once. I had absolutely no connections whatsoever to Australia, and the Australian government should not have, there was absolutely no reason to have been reaching out to meet with a staffer on a campaign three different times within a three-week period leading up to this meeting with Alexander Downer. So during that fateful meeting, I was expecting to meet Alexander Downer, but I was expecting to simply hear his thoughts on the U.S.-Australia relationship, but of course that's not what the purpose of that meeting was.
No, he wanted to quiz you about the stuff that had been planted with you a month earlier with Mifsud, that this idea that the Russians had something. So the Australian government set in motion this meeting. You didn't request it, correct?
No, absolutely not. And in fact, as I mentioned, the Australian government reached out to me by mid-April 2016, yeah. And started to meet with me on three different occasions between April 15th and May 10th, 2016.
Amazing. We now, so yeah. Somebody put that in motion, whether it was the FBI, the CIA, a private entity, the another foreign government, MI6, Britain, whoever ran, it has all the hallmarks of an intelligence operation, and we don't know yet whether that was CIA, FBI, MI6, or maybe even private people calling in chits, right? There are a lot of private intelligence operatives that show up in this network over the course of 3 years, but somebody set that in motion. And then let's fast forward to the other, I think, the most seminal moment. In August, September, you get an invite to go to a Cambridge event. Now we're back in London again. And that comes from a well-known or now well-established FBI informant named Stefan Halper. Talk about how you end up in the presence of Stefan Halper and Asra Turk.
Yes, the infamous Stefan Halper and his so-called assistant. In September of 2016, I'm back in the U.S., and I receive an email out of the blue from Stefan Halper regarding a paper that he wanted me to write on the energy consortium in Israel and Cyprus. And that's why I wanted to make sure that the listeners understood that Downer was very interested in that particular topic just months before Halper messaged me. And I Googled him. I had never heard of him, but he looked legitimate. At that time in my life, I was I was working with think tanks, including the Hudson Institute. So speaking at various policy and energy conferences, commercial conferences. So to get paid $3,000 to write an academic report and present it was in my business model at the time. So there was nothing suspicious about that. I Googled him. He seemed to be the chairman of, I think, American Studies at Cambridge. But little did I know that he was very well connected to both MI6 and the CIA. And he was being run apparently by the FBI, which is still not clear. Of course, the FBI was involved with him, but his assistant, who he introduced to me, or I should say she met with me first, and then I was introduced to Halper, is still an unknown individual. The New York Times never categorically stated that she was FBI. They, in a report about her, they said that she was some sort of government agent, a government employee.
Right.
She was, in my estimation, and what I believe that she portrayed herself as, was a Turkish national, a very heavy act. And it didn't make any sense that I would be meeting with this person in a bar before I was supposed to meet with Stefan Halper. She was very flirtatious, basically trying to get me to repeat the nonsense and the rumors that Mifsud had planted in my mind months ago. I basically laughed her off. And after meeting with her, Halper begins to essentially castigate me about my viewpoints on Turkey and other topics that he was apparently paying me to discuss. So it was a very strange situation, a very strange meeting, but it almost mimicked the meeting I had with Downer just months before that. And that's exactly why I don't think that these were coincidence meetings. I think they were very orchestrated. And if the FBI was running Halper, I'm not surprised if Downer was involved as well with one of the U.S. or foreign intelligence services himself.
All right. So, George, the seminal moment in this comes when Stefan Halper walks into the room and he starts to pump you for some information. It's the moment where a career FBI agent should have said, you know what? Let's drop this thing. It's not what we think it is. Stefan Halper comes in and said, hey, were you guys at the Trump campaign? Are you trying to get Hillary Clinton's emails from Russia? Something to that effect. Remind people what the transcript, what you remember telling Halper back when he was fishing around trying to catch you colluding with Russia. What'd you tell him?
Yes. So so everybody understands, I had absolutely no idea that this person was some sort of informant, that he was recording my conversations.
Right.
And I told him that I don't even know what you're talking about. I have nothing to do with Russia. and neither does the campaign. And a simple Google search or a short, easy security briefing on me would have completely explained to career FBI officials that Papadopoulos has never even traveled to Russia, let alone have any Russian contacts that would have made any sense to even target him for a Russia investigation.
Yeah. Kind of hard to collude if you aren't talking to Russians.
I mean, that's why this is such a massive, in my opinion, I think many would agree, a scandal, because the Russians don't seem to exist in this story. Everybody right. who's in this story seems to be connected to either private Western intelligence firms or Western governments with high-level connections to the U.S. Intelligence agencies. Yeah.
And Great Britain, too.
And I'm glad you brought up Great Britain, because just hours after I told Stefan Halper that I have no idea what you're talking about and anything you're talking about is treason, that's when the British Ministry of Foreign Affairs rolled out the red carpet for me to meet with them in London, where who knows why they were trying to meet with me and record me and on behalf of who and what. So there's a lot that that has yet to be disclosed regarding the British and some foreign governments in the story. But I know that Richard Grenell, when he was acting DNI, declassified some of the transcript with Halper. And during this meeting with Halper, apparently he is the one who's discussing his connections to Russian intelligence. He's the one who's discussing his ties to other intelligence outfits, and I'm sitting there basically enjoying my gin and tonic and nodding my head.
Yeah. So you tell Stefan Halper, not that you knew it, but he was the FBI informant, that we wouldn't do that. It would be illegal. It's not something that the Trump campaign would do. That should have been a big stop moment. And instead, they just ignored you for a while and tried to find some other Trump campaign people to pursue, Mike Flynn, Carter Page, many others that they started to pursue, Paul Manafort. Really remarkable. Now, we now know, that this whole dynamic, we still need more declassifications to figure out the who, what, and when, but we do know sort of what went on in general. I want to go to one other thing, because it just came out the other day, and these are text messages declassified by Attorney General Barr just before he left office today, and they show that the FBI in January of 2017 had an audio tape recording of a conversation you had with a fellow American, a news executive at Fox News, and that stands out for two reasons, because to this date, we believe that the FBI and the Justice Department have told the Congress repeatedly there was never a FISA warrant on you. There was never a Title III phone tap warrant on you. So first off, tell us who you were talking to at Fox News at that moment. Who was the executive?
Yes. So the executive was John Moody, who I think I can't remember his exact title, but some sort of VP position at Fox. I know that his office was situated right next to Rupert Murdoch, so I think he was a pretty high-level official over at Fox at the time. And John and I made contact in July of 2016. He was interested in the campaign. We stayed in touch. We met in his office two or three times, had some phone calls, and apparently we had a phone call of some nature in early January, before the FBI interviewed me, I think at the end of January, where they're listening in on this phone call of mine with another American. And basically, if I remember correctly, the transcript of Peter Strzok is saying that Moody is trying to tip him off or has tipped him off about something or whatnot. And it
Some suggestion that there was some private background check going on. People were checking into your background a few months back, right? That's what the text message says.
I think that's exactly, something along those lines. And it's very strange that there was actually no Title I warrant. There was, as far as we know, no FISA. And the only other option would be if somebody was recording it voluntarily, which I don't believe. But those are the only three options for this to have happened in a somewhat legal fashion.
Now, there's another option that we ought to consider, right? Which is that the FBI, which we saw in the text messages, were frustrated. There are text messages just that predate this by a few days where the FBI is saying they can't get a FISA on you, or that justice won't authorize a FISA on you, probably because there was no basis for illegality to look at. but they're frustrated. One possibility is someone in the U.S. intelligence community asked a foreign-friendly government to listen in and give the transcript. That's a possible end run around the Constitution that we all ought to explore. We don't know, but it's another possibility beyond the ones that you've described that could be there. And I think all of us in the news media, all of those in congressional oversight, you yourself, we ought to demand answers. How did the FBI get an audio transcript or audio recording of a conversation between two Americans when there was no, by their own admission, warrant to capture such conversations? That's something that in 2021, we ought to all set out to find out.
Absolutely. And that's a theory I think is very sound, because my involvement in the Trump campaign was bizarre for the key reason that so many of these foreign governments, including U.S. allies, just continued to want to make me Mr. Popular, take me out for drinks, dinners, meetings at embassies, at Ministry of Foreign Affairs, travel, to various foreign capitals. So it would make complete sense that if these foreign governments were tasked to do some sort of surveillance on me, which I think that seems to be a very logical conclusion, that they might have been involved in this tap of a phone call with another American, because they had absolutely no business to do it.
We don't know, but we certainly have a good reason to ask that question. Somehow we need to find out why Peter Strzok was getting information from an audio recording for which we can't find, at least in the current records and the current testimony, any authorization for. I think that's one of the great mysteries we set out to solve in 2021, George, because I think now that your pardon's occurred, the key now is to get all the rest of the facts out about what happened to you so that no other American citizen goes through the sort of things that you and Mike Flynn and Carter Page went through over three very, very tortuous years. I want to wrap things up because I know you got to get ready for Christmas. I got to get ready for Christmas. I want to ask this last question. As you look back now, 30,000 feet, all that's happened to you, all that you've learned, all of the twists and turns, what is the biggest lesson that Americans should take from the Russia collusion episode as we now know it? And what are you going to take from it personally? What does it inspire you to do next in your life?
Yes, I think looking back at the situation and not fully comprehending what was going on around me until these files were declassified, it's that that all Americans, both on the left, the center, and the right, should never be applauding or happy that unlawful surveillance and abuses traded against your fellow American, because it happened to a Republican presidential campaign in 2016. It could happen to a Democrat in 2022, 2024, and moving forward. We cannot allow the U.S. intelligence community to run amok, to obtain surveillance-less warrants against Americans, like they did Carter Page and possibly others, to wiretap and to essentially manufacture hoaxes to undermine and sabotage rival presidential campaigns because they do not appreciate a particular candidate or his or her viewpoints. That's what I think the key takeaway should be for all Americans, because this is an American story. This is not a partisan story. And I've always tried to make that point in any TV or radio interview I've ever given. Secondly, regarding moving forward, I'm very happy and proud to be with the Newsmax family. It's an incredible channel, continuing to expose what happened in 2016, because what happened in 2016, John, was not an isolated event. It actually impacted not only the last 4 years of everyday American lives, but the entire Trump administration and the 2020 election, and might possibly impact 2022 and 2024. Moving forward, I'm in a very great position. I'm joined the Newsmax family as a contributor. It's a great channel. They're doing incredible work, and I'm very happily married to my wife Simona.
Simona, we're very, I've had the pleasure of meeting.
Absolutely, and I'm very happy that she's going to be in some very large Hollywood productions moving forward that she'll probably disclose at some point in the near future.
Wonderful.
And just continuing to stay involved politically, like every American citizen should, and assuring that this story gets out there. It impacts the Biden administration in a negative way, that as it should, and just seeing where John Durham as a special counsel goes with some of the facts that we've discussed during this interview, because him being appointed a special counsel is really a big deal that has not been quite understood yet by the mainstream media.
Yep. No, it is the big story on this particular front to watch in 2021. Well, George, I want to thank you first. Congratulations on the pardon. I want to wish you and Simona a very blessed and Merry Christmas. Happy start to your 2021 new year. And I'm sure we're going to stay in touch with you because there's so much more to learn on Russia collusion. We're not done getting the truth on this incredible story.
Absolutely, John. Thank you so much. Merry Christmas. Happy holidays. Have a wonderful 2021. And looking forward to talking to you very soon. Thank you so much again.
Thank you, George. Folks, you've been listening to George Papadopoulos, who just got a pardon from President Trump earlier this week. We're going to come back in a few seconds to wrap up the day and get ready, well, for Christmas, as we should be doing.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Ah. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
All right, folks, that wraps up another edition of John Solomon Reports, the Christmas edition of John Solomon Reports. From my family, from my wife Judy, my son Josh, the entire Solomon family, the entire Just the News staff, I want to wish your family a happy holidays, a Merry Christmas, a blessed New Year. I hope this next week provides valuable time for you and your family to enjoy each other, to celebrate all that is still good with America, with your family, even in a difficult year like 2020 has been with COVID and all the other things that have happened. We still have so much more to be thankful for than we have to be angry at. And I hope this holiday season allows you to celebrate the little things in lives that make us tick, that makes our life so valuable, that makes being an American something to be so proud of. I thank you for supporting Just the News and reading us and listening to this podcast. And I hope in 2021, we can deliver even more news, more context, more big interviews, the sort of things that you can trust on your own to appreciate. So we'll be back with you soon and look forward to a new week next week, post-Christmas, when we'll have some new editions of John Solomon Reports. Until then, Merry Christmas.